It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. More people are using apps like Uber, Lyft, and Airbnb to find work, but the work isn't consistent, according to a new study examining the sharing economy. We'll take a look at why that's happening and explore how this type of work is reshaping the way we look at employment. Do you rely on platforms like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb, or some other app to supplement your pay, or is it your full-time work? Just not enough to pay the bills? Do you do it for fun? Maybe the pay is an added bonus. Maybe you rely on these apps for all of your pay. Why is full-time work so hard to come by? 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. Ideas@WPR.org is the email address. You can tweet us at WPR Mornings. We're going to be talking about this, and we'll take your calls as soon as we have some lined up. So 800-642-1234. Tell us how you're doing in the sharing economy. Arun Sundarrajan is a professor and a Robert L. and Dale Atkins Rosen Faculty Fellow at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. Arun, welcome to The Morning Show.
John, delighted to be on.
You've written a lot about the sharing economy. First, tell us exactly what that term means. When you say sharing economy, what do you mean?
Well, I'm talking about a family of changes that are reorganizing how we sort of deliver goods and services in the economy. Instead of big companies hiring people full-time, offering them sort of a stable job and benefits and, you know, the companies delivering the goods and services to people, we instead are moving into an economy where platforms are aggregating demand from consumers and then connecting to sort of these distributed and independent workers and small businesses who provide similar goods and services. So instead of going and watching television provided by a big TV channel and a big studio, you go to YouTube, which is a big company, but aggregating the content from millions of tiny content providers. Instead of going to a hotel, you go to an Airbnb with millions of hosts. Instead of going to a transportation company, you go to Uber or Lyft with its millions of drivers.
So which digital platform seems to be the most popular among people seeking work today?
Well, it depends on what kind of work you're seeking. I think if you're someone who wants to earn money driving a car, Uber is certainly the most popular, although Lyft is catching up. If you want to make extra money renting out a spare bedroom or renting out your home when you're not there, Airbnb is far and away the most popular platform for that. If you're looking to make extra money sort of with, you know, extend your small business into the digital realm or your freelance work into the digital realm, let's say you're doing yard work or you're doing home cleaning, TaskRabbit is popular, Thumbtack is popular, Handy is popular. And so it really depends. That there seem to be sort of marketplaces and platforms for specific professions and for specific ways of making money that have taken off. If you're a computer programmer, you go to Upwork.
Well, it seems like new apps are popping up all the time for this the gig economy, as it were. From what you've written, we can expect to see this trend to continue. For today's youth, you write that the future of work may be more uncertain than ever. Are we headed to a point where we just won't have traditional employment anymore?
I don't think we're going to actually completely get rid of the full-time job, but we'll probably get to a point where it's the exception rather than the norm. You know, at the beginning of the 20th century, full-time work was not that common. It was more common to own your own farm or to sort of work as a freelance worker. And then over the second half of the 20th century, we got used to this idea that work is the same as someone paying you a stable income and, you know, you providing your labor and talent to them. I just think we're swinging back to what we've historically seen, which is, you know, people working for themselves will become much more common. This is a good thing in many ways because it allows you to pursue your dreams. It allows you flexibility. It gives you a lot more leeway to do what you want to do rather than what you have to do. The downside at this point is that we've constructed a lot of the good things of the economy, a lot of the stability, a lot of the benefits, a lot of the, like, you know, the paid vacations, the predictability of income, all of that social safety net, at least in the United States, has been constructed assuming that people are going to hold a full-time job and that there is this entity called the employer who can participate. And so for today's freelance workers, since we're in transition, they don't have as robust a social safety net, and so things can seem a little fragile, they can seem a little more uncertain than they should be.
I would imagine that it also makes it more difficult to collect taxes. I mean, a lot of this economy, gig economy, is cash, isn't it?
Well, some of it is, but one of the benefits of the large digital platforms is that they're actually formalizing a lot of what used to be informal as they grow it. And so, you know, if people used to rent other people's apartments through Craigslist, say, or, like, you know, you went to Europe for the summer, you would rent someone's apartment there, and a lot of this was off the books. Now that all that business flows through platforms like Airbnb and VRBO, who are sort of sending 1099s to the federal government, it seems like while the informal, like, you know, while the gig sort of portion of the economy is growing, a lot of what used to be informal and sort of under the table is now being formalized. So I think this is actually good news for the IRS.
Okay, well, I guess the other thing, I've seen some other articles that are kind of headed in this direction, and that is we're in sort of a race to the bottom in terms of the internet making a lot of these individual piecework kinds of things global, and you have people who will work for a dollar in some country that a dollar means more than it does in the United States. Is that a potential real problem here, that people will just make a lot less money for the work that they would like to do?
Well, I think that it depends, again, on what profession you're talking about. In the long run, I'm not worried about wages sort of, like, you know, being driven down in this race to the bottom, because wages in other countries will catch up, or at least sort of, like, you know, start to rise the way they have in India for software engineering or in China for manufacturing. But I think there will be a transition period where if you do the kind of work where you don't actually have to be physically co-located with the person who you're doing the work for, you will see some downward pressure on your wages, or your wages could go down because of the gig economy. On the other hand, if you actually have to be physically present, the gig economy platforms may actually raise your wages. So, for example, if you make your money painting fences, if you make your money as an electrician, if you make your money as a plumber, if you make your money as an event planner, all of these are professions where you actually have to be in the same geographic area as your client. And so international labor competition isn't really going to affect you. Okay. On the other hand, if you're a web designer, if you're a computer programmer, if you sort of do graphic art, these are things where someone in another country can do the same work that you're doing, even if their clients are thousands of miles away. So my research shows that there will be some downward pressure on wages in the short run.
We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. We're talking about the gig economy with Arun Sundararajan, professor at the New York University Stern School of Business. It's the Ideas Network. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. A lot of people are starting to use apps like Uber, Lyft, Airbnb to find employment. But the work isn't consistent, according to a new study examining the sharing economy. Arun Sundararajan is a professor of business at New York University's Stern School of Business. He wrote the book, The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. In a study J.P. Morgan Chase recently conducted, it showed that more people were using apps to find work, and we've talked about why people might gravitate toward that. But there have been other things. There have been a lot of discussion about this study since it came out. One of the things is that one of the reasons people gravitate toward these is that the barriers to entry are so low that it makes sense for workers to just dabble in this kind of work occasionally. Does that mean that this is an opportunity for people to try something they might not have thought about doing before, but, well, I can do this?
Well, I think that the fraction of Americans who are earning part of their income through freelance work, even though they have a full-time job, has grown steadily in the last 15 or 20 years. I think one in five Americans who has a full-time job actually supplements it with some sort of consulting or freelance work or gig work on the side. And so these platforms definitely present an opportunity to, you know, sort of dip your toes in the water and see if this kind of work is good for you, and also build some skills running your own business, being a micro entrepreneur. Another interesting thing that I think the study highlights is that the volume of work done on these platforms seems to be growing, but the number of hours per week that the average worker is working on, say, a platform like Uber seems to have dropped quite significantly. And so while more and more Americans are, you know, dabbling in the gig economy, it seems that increasingly, at least in the short run, they're not doing it as their primary income source, but they're using it as their secondary income source.
And what about the hourly wages that people make doing things like driving for Uber or Lyft? How does that compare to what they might make if they had what we might call a regular job?
Well, you know, if you compare, it depends on, I guess, which city you're talking about and what you're comparing it to. If you compare how much Lyft and Uber drivers make per hour after all expenses in New York City, they're doing slightly better than yellow taxi drivers used to do a few years ago, doing the same kind of work, and they have more flexibility. But the absolute level of, you know, earnings per hour are still not very high. We're going to have to do some things over the next few years to make sure that we push them up sort of beyond the $15 to $20 range.
Yes, the study found that over the last 5 years, monthly earnings across the gig economy have gone down. You mentioned that. It also shows that most people did not use one of these platforms for more than a quarter of the year. How does that factor into, for example, our falling unemployment rates?
Well, I think the, you know, the full-time job market, you know, is very strong. But I think what the unemployment numbers don't depict is that while the fraction of the workforce that is unemployed is very low, over the last 30 years, the earnings of people, especially in sort of the mid-range income level of the job market, have been stagnant. There's been this hollowing out of the middle class. And so an increasing number of people are going to these online platforms to try and supplement their income, or are choosing sort of a second job, part-time job, to try and sort of bring up their income. And I think the numbers in the study bear that out, because they're showing that more people are participating, but, you know, the fact that they're earning less per month on average, or that they're doing it only at a particular time of the year, is really a signature of it being part-time work to supplement your main income, or occasional work at a particular point in the year where you feel your expenses are high and you need to generate some extra cash.
All right. Well, I know you have to leave us. This seems like as good a place as any to end the conversation. Arun Sundararajan, thank you so much for spending this time with us this morning. I really appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, John, for having me. And to your listeners, I'm easy to find online. So if you had questions that you didn't ask me and you want to shoot me an email or send me a tweet, I'd be more than happy to answer them.
Great. Thank you. Thank you so much. Arun Sundararajan is professor and in the Robert L. and Dale Atkins Rosen Faculty Fellow at New York University Stern School of Business. He wrote the book The Sharing Economy, The End of Employment and the Rise of Crowd-Based Capitalism. In just a minute, we'll be looking at why 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or higher on reading, math, and science assessment tests. But first, Republicans in Wisconsin's 1st Congressional District are fighting hard to hold on to the seat House Speaker Paul Ryan has held for nearly two decades. As Laurel White reports, a former Ryan staffer is facing off in the race against a Democrat who's hoping to harness party enthusiasm to flip the seat.
Last year, millions of dollars started flowing into Wisconsin from all over the country with one purpose: defeat Paul Ryan in 2018. The money mostly went to Democrat Randy Bryce, an ironworker and union activist who had run and lost previous elections for state and local offices. But Bryce clearly struck a chord this time with his campaign announcement video released in June 2017.
I think it's time. Let's trade places. Paul Ryan, you can come work the iron, and I'll go to D.C.
Bryce's ad went viral. He got millions of dollars in out-of-state campaign contributions and the endorsement of Senator Bernie Sanders, who won Wisconsin's Democratic presidential primary in 2016. But almost a year later, the narrative changed when Paul Ryan dropped out of the race.
What I realize is, if I am here for one more term, my kids will only have ever known me as a weekend dad. I just can't let that happen.
Republicans chose Brian Stile, an attorney and member of the University of Wisconsin Board of Regents, as their party's nominee for the seat. In an early campaign ad, Stile introduced himself as a conservative outsider who could bring Wisconsin-style politics to Washington.
Because I was raised right here in Janesville on Southeast Wisconsin-style values, I don't care much for Washington-style politics.
It's Stile's first campaign for office, but he's hardly a newcomer to GOP politics. He was once a staffer for Ryan and was a delegate at the Republican National Convention in 2016. Stile and his allies have tried to frame the race around Bryce's background. Republican groups have run ads pointing out that Bryce has been arrested 9 times for crimes including drunk driving and property damage. Joe Zepecki is a Democratic strategist who's worked on a number of campaigns in Wisconsin. He says Bryce has responded well to those attacks.
He's put it out there and said, this is who I am. Take it or leave it. You know what? We've got enough people with Ivy League credentials and who have never gotten in trouble in their whole life in Congress, and look where it's gotten us.
Not everyone agrees. Randy Bryce's own brother, James Bryce, supports Stile and even cut a TV ad on his behalf. Mark Grawl is a Republican strategist who's worked on statewide campaigns. He acknowledges Republicans are facing headwinds in the 2018 election, but says Stile has run a strong race in a GOP district.
I mean, I think he fits the district well. His background in manufacturing, I think, is a real positive right now. I think his work in the community with his family is something that is also a real positive, and I think a big contrast with Randy Bryce.
Bryce is trying to draw his own contrasts, comparing Stile's work as a corporate attorney to his own blue-collar background.
It's not about who's the more perfect person to represent you. It's about who understands the hardships that you're going to face in order to make your world a better place.
When it comes to issues, the two follow partisan divides seen elsewhere this election cycle. Bryce supports Medicare for All and the Affordable Care Act's protections for people with pre-existing conditions. Stile says more price transparency and increased use of health savings accounts would make the healthcare system better. The race doesn't have the national profile it once did, but millions of dollars are still being spent here. As Stile fights to hold on to a GOP district, and Bryce tries to harness Democratic enthusiasm to flip it. Laurel White, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up on the morning show, in the 2017-2018 school year, roughly 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or higher on reading, math, and science assessment tests, and that number hasn't changed much in the past few years. In just a few moments, we'll take a look at what those numbers mean and what this looks like from the point of view of a teacher. But first, do your out-of-town friends chuckle when you talk because you're just so Wisconsin? Uh-huh. I can hear it now. Tomorrow on the morning show, we're going to learn about that Wisconsin accent, and we want to hear from you. Here's what we'd like you to do. Call our voicemail and just say this sentence. The latest ag report shows strong production, but with the hot weather now, Dawn knows there's bad news coming today. I'm not going to repeat that. The number to call is 833-42-IDEAS, 833-42-IDEAS. Now, if you've already forgotten the sentence, which I have, that's okay. You'll hear a reminder when you call. So, we want to hear you speak Scani. Just dial 833-424-3327, 833-424-3327, or 833-42-IDEAS, and let us hear you speak some Scani. I think this is going to be fun. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. In the 2017-2018 school year, roughly 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or higher on reading, math, and science assessment tests, and that number hasn't changed much in the past few years. We're going to take a look at what these numbers might mean and what this looks like from the point of view of teachers. Are you surprised that only about 40% of Wisconsin students scored as proficient or advanced in reading, math, and science? Why do you think it's only 40%? Why do you think this number hasn't moved much over the past few years? Maybe you're a parent or a teacher. What are your thoughts on standardized testing in Wisconsin? And is it fair to apply the same standard everywhere? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. Or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Scott Kirst is an assistant professor of education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Good morning, Scott, and welcome to the morning show. Scott, hello. Can you hear
me? Yes, I'm here.
Oh, okay, great.
I can.
Okay, we needed a little more string between our Dixie cups, I think, here this morning. Okay, in the last school year, 40% of Wisconsin students, or thereabouts, scored proficient or advanced on language arts, math, and science assessments. I guess the first question is, what about the other 60%?
Well, that's a great question. The other 60% would be considered minimal or basic. Those would be individual, still trying to get the different types of learning that's happening in the classroom. And when we hear these numbers of 40%, a lot of us go back to our old school days and remember 40% was an F. We can't really look at these numbers this way. That 60% is actually very intriguing for a teacher. They're saying, okay, we have these 40%. Now, what do I need to do? What are the resources? What are the activities? How do I get to know these individual students so we could raise it up? So many people see assessments as an endpoint, that it's an evaluation of what you've done. In education, teachers, professors, those that are used to it, this is a beginning point. This is a great point for us to start and say, okay, what has worked in the past and what's going to work in the future?
Okay, but these numbers have stayed pretty steady over the past several years. What do you think that tells us about the state of elementary and high school education in Wisconsin?
Well, you have to understand that we have the Common Core State Standards.
Okay, I think we're having a problem with our connection here. We're going to switch to cell phone. In the meantime, I will ask our callers to get involved in this discussion. Are you surprised by the numbers in this latest report on how we're doing on standardized testing? Or maybe you think standardized testing is bunk and we shouldn't be doing it at all. Maybe you're a parent or a teacher. What are your thoughts on what these numbers mean? And is it fair to apply the same standard everywhere? Does it even make sense? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at WPR Mornings. Let's take a call here. Kevin is with us from Oregon. Kevin, good morning. Thanks for joining us on the morning show.
Good morning. I have a daughter in middle school, and we struggled with her reading curriculums for the last 2 or 3 years. And we have just found that the teachers don't have the ability to spend time on reading skills, and such that we have private tutoring now being used to try to improve our daughter's skills. So there's a significant change in the methods and the availability of the teachers to actually deliver those skills. There's a lot of distractions from other students in the class, which are taking a significant amount of time away from actually skill development. And we're just finding it very difficult to see the penetration of these skills in the schools today.
Kevin, thanks for your call. Scott Kirst?
Yes, I'm right here.
Did you hear Kevin's call?
Yes, I did. And actually, that is an issue. When we talk about a lot of these things, we always... What I hear in the news is the idea of an achievement gap, where it's really truly an opportunity gap, that we're not allowing our students the opportunities to learn as everyone. A lot of the students are coming in with issues, with things that are coming outside. They're not being fed. They're not being helped. They're coming in with more issues. And if we were to just have them, come in and we can just teach them, These standards are great. The methods, the teachers in Wisconsin are excellent. But we have a lot of things that we have to work on with these students in addition to just teaching them math or just teaching them literacy.
What about Kevin's point that there were so many distractions in the classroom that the teachers seem to be prevented from really doing what needs to be done to help students learn how to read or do math or whatever it is they're working on?
Well, I'm not a sociologist, but you can talk to a lot of teachers, a lot of people in the educational system that really are stating now that there are a lot more things that children have to deal with nowadays, that there's a lot of tension in families. There's a lot of tension in the social structures, with social media, with all these other distractions that are coming out. We have to really change the ways that we are approaching this. It used to be that we never heard about this stuff, but now we are. And so as teachers, we're really passionate about trying to get these students to a level where their brains are able to take in this intellectual material. And they're not worried about, will I be able to eat this weekend? Or, what's going to happen on my way to school? And every teacher cares about that. Every teacher has a passion. We get to know each and every student. And sometimes it really hurts us going home and knowing that they're not having the structures that they need to learn adequately.
We have a caller from Ladysmith. Next, let's go to Barb. And yes, Barb, good morning. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. One of the things that I wanted to point out, I've been a testing coordinator in our district for the last 20 years, and that's that you said that the testing scores were flat for the last 3 years. 3 years ago, we switched to a different test. And while that's only one factor, I don't think it can be ignored that the test that we're using now is not exactly, it doesn't test the students in the way that they're used to, that they're being educated. And so it's a lot difficult. And so everyone's scores went down 3 years ago.
Barb, thanks for sharing that insight. Scott Kirst?
Yeah, excellent. That's exactly the point. So many individuals want this to be a switch, but because the curriculum builds off each other, and when you change the test, you're changing the things that you're actually evaluating, we need to build the scaffolding ideas between the students from kindergarten to first to second to third. This is not something we're going to see a huge change from year to year, but we're going to see that increase. So it is difficult when things change because people are saying it's not working fast enough. This is not this is not something that can be done in 6 months, a year. This may take decades.
State education officials pointed out that there's been a slight improvement in math scores. 41.1% of students proficient or better in math, up from 40.3% in 2015. That sounds like a small increase, but is it actually small, or is this statistically significant?
That's a great point. A lot of times we don't have a lot of that data given to us that just says, here's your number. What the schools do, though, the schools get those numbers. They're able to look at it, see the students that actually increase, see if any decrease. what are the issues? And then the schools use that number. The schools use the subsets of all those numbers to help direct individual students in classrooms. As far as number going up and down, it really is not meaningful for any school district. Sometimes it is for the individuals in the public who like saying my school district is a 40 and yours is a 39, that's better. Well, not really. You know, what we do, we use this data and all the subsets of this data to help guide how can we educate each individual student better every year.
And what do we mean by proficient?
Well, that's a great question. A lot of people like saying, oh, advanced is A, proficient is B, and so on and so forth. That's not what we're talking about. What proficient means is that if you are given a certain task or a certain performance standard, they are able to demonstrate a large portion of it or all of it in some sort of artifact, in some sort of assessment. That's what proficient means. That's what we're aiming for, that everyone meets this. The standards are written developmentally so that we can say at a given grade level, this is what an average student should be able to comprehend developmentally, which means that there are going to be some students that are above and obviously some students who are below. If we had performance standards where everyone was 100%, we'd be questioned, honestly. All these assessments would be questioned if everyone is making that. So we're getting away from comparing ourselves to others to this is where you should be. If you're not, how can we help you out?
Scott Kirst is an assistant professor of education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. We're talking about the results released this past week from the most recent round of standardized tests given to students in Wisconsin. Are you a parent or teacher? What are your thoughts on standardized testing in Wisconsin? And is it fair to apply the same standard everywhere? Does it even make sense? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. We'll take your calls and we'll continue our conversation about test scores and what they mean in just a moment. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson. We're talking about the results contained in a recent report on test scores from Wisconsin's K-12 schools. You can join in our discussion. What do you think about these test scores? What do they mean? Do they mean anything? Is this something that you're concerned about? 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. My guest is Scott Kirst, Assistant Professor of Education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. Scott, we've got another caller with us. Chris is with us from Hillsboro. Chris, good morning. Thanks for joining us on The Morning Show.
Good morning. I'm a special ed teacher, and I do elementary and middle school, and I've also done high school. These tests are not always reliable. We over-test these kids. They have to take district tests. They have to take state tests. And then they have to take their unit tests, and they have to do this. And we just took a MAPS test at school, and my students did okay. But literally, there were so many questions. Who sits there and wants to read 50 different questions for reading or read these long passages and stuff? A lot of them aren't reading it. I learned more from working one-on-one with my students and being able to help them. But like a previous caller said, we don't have time. We're dealing with even the floods here in Wisconsin. We have kids that with such high anxiety when it starts raining, they lose it. So test scores give us an idea, but on a given day, the test score is going to be different every single day depending on their mood, if they had breakfast, if they got in a fight with their parents, you know, or if they're going to Disney World. So I don't take too much into the test. They're nice to have those scores, and I know what to work on, but they change.
Chris, thanks so much for that call. Scott Kirst, are we making these tests too high in terms of the stakes here?
And I agree with everything Chris said. I think it's a snapshot. It's one focal point. It's one data point that we can use. But if you tell me that you're going to test the person one day, and then I'm supposed to make a decision the next 364 days, I would take a special ed teacher sitting down with a student every day and getting to know them all the time. These standardized tests, again, are just part of a large assessment data system that we have. And a lot of times these are just simply literacy tests, or they could just be concentration tests, tests in which if you cannot concentrate or focus, you're not going to do well. So, again, I'm not, obviously every teacher is here. They're like, great, that's a wonderful data point. But I also have this data, this data, this data, this data, this data. We have to really make sure that we don't lose it. And unfortunately, this is so public that individuals that maybe are not part of an educational system might use this and think, okay, this is the Super Bowl. This is the only indicator we have. And we are this number and this school is this number, therefore we're not as good. We can't do that. We have to look at it holistically. We have to look at different assessments.
We had a caller who asked that we discuss the difference between standardized tests and standard-based tests because they seem to be used interchangeably, but they're not the same thing.
Absolutely. Okay. And a standardized test is a test, the same test under the same conditions given to the students throughout a population. So that means that the test is standardized. A standards-based test is a test that actually addresses the performance standards of math or of literacy or whatever you have. So we use this standardized test to evaluate the standards. But there are other standardized tests. The ACT or the SAT, for example, do not directly assess the Common Core state standards or the other state standards that are out there. So when we talk about standards, it's not a curricula. It's actually just a set of knowledge and skills that students should be able to do at certain developmental levels. They never tell how a teacher teaches. It never tells how to assess it. But what it does tell you is that this is where they should be able to go on average.
Let's talk about money, because that seems to always come up in these discussions. What's your assessment of the state of funding for public education in Wisconsin? Do we need to be spending more?
I think we need to be spending more to get more opportunities for our students to connect with our wonderful teachers in Wisconsin. The class sizes, the less interaction we're getting with our students is really hurting that the people on the ground, the ones who actually know our students, the ones that know where they struggle, where their strengths are, where their opportunities are. And sometimes it's frustrating going into a school and a teacher says, I can help these students. I just don't have the time. Or I can help these students, but there's so many other needs I need. So I think when it comes to funding, we have to make sure it's funneled to the right people, the ones who are in direct contact with our students and the students that need the help. The teachers, the guidance counselors, the principals, the ones that could really make a difference in these children's lives.
And what about infrastructure? How much does upgrading infrastructure in schools matter when it comes to teaching?
Well, there was a time in which we were very, very proud of all of our schools, that they were pillars of the community. They were wonderful buildings that really stood the test of time. And now I think many individuals, we've been very spoiled with that. If you go to any town in Wisconsin, you'll see these beautiful brick buildings that are gorgeous from the outside, but the inside is crumbling. So, yes, we do have to make sure that there are learning environments that are there for the students. There's a lot of issues with asbestos. There's a lot of issues with safety, with wiring. Even with new technology, it's very difficult sometimes to upgrade these buildings. So if we do have a passion as a public to get every single student, not only Wisconsin, but in the United States, we have to really invest in infrastructure so that we can actually have a learning environment that is conducive to high expectations and high achievement.
Wisconsin has an achievement gap based on wealth or the lack of it and on racial disparities, and it's one of the largest in the nation, and it has not narrowed. What can we do to address racial disparities in educational opportunity and resources?
Great question. And inside the educational community, we really do not like the word achievement gap, because that actually puts the onus on the student. And it's not the student's issue. It is an opportunity gap. We, as adults, are not giving our students, our various students in any community, a lot of the opportunities that other students do. A lot of things that we do are wonderful, but we don't have a lot of the funding or the ideas to get the opportunities to other individuals. We have to meet them where they are. We can't just have a blanket, hey, this worked here, this worked here. I think Wisconsin is one of the most innovative states when it comes to education and what teachers are doing, and we're trying. They're doing an excellent job, but again, a lot of the issues that were brought up before of mental health, of going home to a family in which they're arguing, or there's issues with opioid abuse. These are issues that are beyond what we can control, and it really limits the opportunities of everyone.
Some teachers and parents are concerned that focusing on standardized testing turns learning into a numbers game, and we're just teaching to the test. Is that a fair concern?
No, not at all. If you were to look at the standards are actually just a floor. And I think every teacher pretty much would say, yes, on average, most of my students would be able to do this. I think a lot of parents are starting to, they talk to the teachers. And the teachers and the parents, they're a team. We're a team to help that student get that achievement. And when we look at it, it is a floor. It's kind of like, okay, this is where we're going to start. And this is how we want your students to go. So it's a common language. So the student, the parents, the guardians, the teacher, everyone is on the same team. And we're all attacking this knowledge in a positive, fruitful way.
Looking ahead, Scott, what changes do you hope to see when it comes to standardized testing in Wisconsin?
I guess I would love to see some more education of the general public on what these tests are and what other indicators are out there to talk about your individual students or individual schools. Again, this is just one number. It can be different from day to day, from week to week. Also, I think we need to talk about patients. And actually look at the trends and look at a growth mindset rather than just a, hey, we're here. When we start looking at, are we growing, are the individual students growing, that's really what I'd like to
okay.
see, more education with all of us.
All right, Scott, thank you very much. I really appreciate your time. Scott Kirst is an assistant professor of education at St. Norbert College in De Pere. I'm John Munson. This is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.